I will spend a lot of time talking about the benefits of positivity. Not because it's nice to be positive, but because positivity delivers real-time benefits in personal effectiveness and builds psychological resources over time that make a person better and more, bring them closer to their potential in that spectrum that we're talking about. I spent a lot of time talking about kindness and love in the context of leadership.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hi there, welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. This is episode number 45. This week you're in for a real treat. We have on the show Graham Keane, author of Positive Leaders and Positive Change. Graham is a business psychologist and has studied under the father of positive psychology, Dr. Martin Seligman. Graham has over 20 years' experience advising more than 200 companies on engineering lasting positive change. Peppered with wonderful soundbites from Graham, we look at the benefits of positivity, what it means to be kind rather than being a hard-ass boss, what values do we need to ensure positivity, and does your brain work on the basis that whatever you tell it, it'll believe it to be positive, whether you believe it or not. We uncover the myth that anybody can be anything as long as they believe in it, and wrap up the show as usual with three leadership essentials and a very kind offer to you, our listeners, from Graham himself. Over to the pod.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today we have our first Doncaster-based guest, so I'm quite beside myself being from Doncaster. I'm delighted to be joined by Graham Keane, the author of Positive Leaders, Positive Change. Graham, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit of your backstory so our listeners get a sense of who you are?
Thank you very much. It's a long time since I've been introduced as a Donny lad.
I love a Donny lad.
I know, you can't like it. So I am a, my marketing, I don't know what to call them, the people I pay to do my marketing tell me I'm a business-specific positive psychologist. But before that, I had a career as an accountant and ultimately as a CFO of three small PLCs. So the way I earn my living is from a blend of business psychology and experience in the boardroom, managing your teams on the one hand and the expectations and requirements of your shareholders on the other hand. So how I got to that is a long and hopefully interesting story, but I won't make it long. But I the switch came from the CFO career to the psychology career in 1997, when I had been working actually for a few years as a corporate finance advisor, i.e. somebody who helped organizations finance themselves. And specifically, I was heavily involved in mergers and acquisitions. And after a few years of doing that, noticing how lucrative it was for the people who were the principals, I thought, I'll do one for myself. So I put a few years into doing one for myself, the culmination of which was that 5 days before we floated that on the stock exchange, we discovered that one of the lawyers involved was a crook and had stolen some money, which meant that we weren't able to float it. So that all fell apart. And that wasn't very good for my psyche. I was going to say I was a braces wearing corporate finance guy, but you know, some things never change. I was not the resilient individual that I hope I now am. And when you lack resilience, when you get your way through being able to manipulate and frankly intimidate other people, when you're a charismatic autocrat who basically pushes their way through life, one of the things that happens is that your resilience is low, because you have Well, for many reasons, one of which is you don't need to rehearse it very often because you tend to get your own way. But when force majeure collapses your universe, your internal resources that you need at that point aren't very good. So I was a bit of a mess for a while. And I came back from being a mess by being introduced by friends to what is now an outmoded concept, but at the time was life-saving for me, which is just positive thinking. Now, you know, positive thinking, as people will may or may not know, sort of went from 1920 through to 1970s. And it has a lot to offer. And it also makes a lot of claims that are false and unsubstantiated. The chief one of which is anybody can be anything so long as they believe. That's a lie. That's a very, very big lie. And it's been responsible for as much tragedy as it has success and fulfillment. So anyway, I bought into the credible aspects of it and ran my life by it, which, you know, as these things are, you know, before too long there was a knock on the door, somebody needed a managing director to run a motivational training company. So I did that for 3 years. And during that time, I became increasingly dissatisfied by the lack of science that there then was substantiating a positive approach to things like leadership and culture change. And in the end, my business partners and I at that time decided to split, and they went off. They become very successful doing what they do, which is heavily sport focused. And I set up my current company, which is currently we trade as the Positive Profitability Company. So that explains what we do in as few words as we can. that was a one room startup, you know, me and my then wife, a telephone, a computer in a single room. We were very much interested in pursuing the science behind things like motivation, behavioral change, leadership. And then in 2003, I studied with the father of positive psychology, Professor Martin Seligman from the University of Pennsylvania, who was then arguably the most eminent psychologist in the world. And that's when I got my training as a psychologist. And ever since that, the completion of that program, the promise that I've made to all of our delegates and all of our clients is, I'm not going to teach anything that hasn't been proven by peer-reviewed research. So it's everything is evidence-based. Shall I draw breath for a second?
Graham, welcome to the show. Fabulous to have you on. I'm curious just to pick your brains on something you said a little bit earlier, and that was around about the anybody could be anything sort of myth. And I'm wondering where you think that came from. Is it more of an American kind of base thing? And what is it about that that has been so pervasive and that people still may be sort of attached to that myth? Because you could spend an awful lot of time trying to run a business because you had this anybody could be anything kind of view, and yet you were probably heading down some sort of a cul-de-sac. And I just wonder what your thoughts were around that.
I think the genesis of it was American. The great authors and individuals there were very successful men. I'm thinking about people like Dale Carnegie, like Andrew Carnegie, you know, totally different front, like Napoleon Hill. They were all American Christian WASPs, all right? And their thinking was heavily involved, heavily inspired by their religious beliefs. And I think the crossover between, you know, faith can move mountains and anybody can be anyone, this is a personal opinion, it's clear to see. It's an amazingly powerful idea.
Yeah.
And it's a very empowering idea. And it's very attractive. And when done well, it gets people past limiting beliefs, between limiting despair that they've put in place, which is unjustified, and where they're trapped into self-destructive thinking, and it can get them across that. So that's where it's strong and powerful and empowering. Where it's disempowering, as you're implying, John, is that it can encourage people to, you know, keep plowing a furrow that's never going to lead anywhere but to a stone wall.
Yeah.
You know, Einstein's definition of insanity, to keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. It can trap people into that. And one of the reasons that we can now call it a myth rather than just say, well, it's a position of faith or it's a worldview and it's as valid as anybody else's. It's not actually as valid as anybody else's. Because we now know, for instance, we know that the relationship, we know precisely what the relationship is between nature and nurture. Now, it's pretty obvious that if I decide to become a ballet dancer, it's not going to fly. A, because I ain't got it, and B, because of my age. And also, I don't exactly have a ballet dancer's physique. But there are lots of people who have that potential within themselves, but don't realize it. And so what is it that makes the difference between somebody who has the potential and doesn't know and somebody who clearly hasn't? And it's the difference between nature and nurture. That debate was over decades ago. And what we now know is that your genome, your genetics, sets a range within which you can perform. Never going to be worse than this, can't be better than that. Whether you're talking about your ability as a, we were talking pre going public about, you know, coaching, that whether it's one's ability as a coach or one's ability as a ballerina, your intellect, your personality traits, all these things, you've got this range. And that's nature. What nurture does, what our lifelong conditioning does, it positions us within there. And I think one of the reasons that the myth took hold is that the difference between somebody in their comfort zone, you know, sort of just below the midpoint of their, I call it a spectrum of potential. So when they're just, you know, taking things easy, the difference between there, what they're achieving, and what they can do if they get towards their full potential is mind-blowing. It's incredible. It's responsible for things like the in 19... when was it? 53, the world record holder for the 4-minute mile, was suddenly, and his world record was 4 minutes, 1 point something, was blown away when Roger Bannister did it in sub 4. So he thought, oh my God, it is possible. So he went and had another go, and he knocked, this is the world champion, yeah? He knocked 3.5 seconds off his personal best. You know, that's the sort of thing that we're capable of when we remove the limiting beliefs that allow us to get close to our full potential.
I think that's wonderfully explained.
Thank you.
Because it does remind me, back in the day, that those people that you've talked about, Napoleon Hill, Dale Carnegie, they were very popular and had many, many followers. And it's interesting that it's sort of, it's like gospel, isn't it? You know, if you keep giving people something to hang on to, then they'll pretty much follow it, depending on where you find them on the path.
It is, and religious faith is massively, massively empowering and massively powerful. It's a wonderful. I'm not a person of faith, but I have huge respect for those that are. Whatever religion that they're pursuing, because it provides much of the internal resource that positive psychology provides when people need it. You know, yeah. I'm thinking specifically there about resilience.
Yeah, I think the thing that you did mention, though, about Professor Martin Seligman and some of his work in positive psychology that really has helped is the work on tapping into strengths, and that very much is operating in that boundary of nature and what you're capable of. And the difference with, I suppose, the religious narrative is it's generalized to anybody and it doesn't become personalized to what you're best at and what you're most capable of. And when we look at the work of positive psychologists like Martin Seligman, he has spent like decades trying to really explore and measure and create tools that people can tap into, what makes them unique, where their range is, how can they can propel themselves forward. What is it about Professor Martin Seligman's work that really excited you and drew you to go and study with him, I suppose?
I think it was that it fulfilled a long felt want in me, which was to get past traditional thinking about things like motivation. So when I first entered, I first became the MD of that motivational training company. When they were teaching motivation, they were teaching Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which probably many people listening to this are very familiar with. And I'm not disrespecting Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Or Maslow, as people call him in Europe. It's just that, you know, people don't realize that he did that work in 1958. Okay, so, you know, there must be more. And indeed, one of the signal contributions of Seligman is to update that with the thing called the PERMA model, which is, you know, when you remove coercion from human beings, whether it's starvation or safety or whatever, what do they seek? And that they seek well-being, which is the update on the thinking of Maslow. Well-being, however, to a positive psychologist is something very specific. It's not necessarily what your HR department will, unless they're educated in positive psychology, will mean when they're talking about well-being, as there are five specific elements of it. And, you know, positive psychology is now a major science. Every university has their department. And it's also a movement that Seligman founded in 98. And the objective of the positive psychology movement is to improve human well-being, full stop. That's it. It's an interesting story I'm having a bit of a brag, really. So in 03, Seligman decided it was time to educate the psychology profession in the work that had been done since 95. He started working in 95 when he was called out by his daughter to be a grouch. and he thought, you know, she's right, I am a grouch. And why is that? I'm the president of the American Psychological Association. I'm a professor of psychology. Surely I ought to be able to be a nice chap. And that started him thinking about what had gone wrong. And he decided he was going to return psychology to its roots, typified by William James in the 1890s, which was all about maximizing one's potential and fulfillment from life. And 2003, he thought, right, I'm ready to go. And he educated 1,000 psychologists worldwide in the work that had been done 95 to 2003. And I was one of them. We call ourselves the Vanguard. And I was one of the first five positive psychologists in the UK.
Incredible. Like, just such a tremendous achievement, but just so fascinating. I can't even blows my mind all the stuff you must know. And I suppose where we really love it is psychology, I think, traditionally was always about getting somebody that more recent tradition from getting somebody that was having issues and perhaps mental ill health back to zero. And where positive psychology is really influence coaching is to really, what do you do when somebody's at zero, and is that enough, and how do you get them from zero to that definition of well-being? And where I get excited is a lot of our coaching is massively influenced by Martin Seligman and the work that he did in positive psychology. And a lot of the interventions we use are very much positive psychology based.
Brilliant.
And from a coaching psychology point of view. But it is quite fascinating how many people are okay just being around that kind of -1 to -3 mark and not really tapping into what's possible and their potential. So tell us what it is that you do and how do you really tap into people or helping people uncover their potential?
Wow, that's a really big question. I love the way you think about coaching. I'm a massive fan. I love it. And can I just say before I answer your question, one of the things that excites me about it, you mentioned Seligman on strengths.
Mm.
It's more than how to optimize your strengths and use them. It's the fact that what came out of his work is that if you're not using your natural signature strengths, you're never going to be fulfilled. You're never going to have well-being. And that's new. I love that you do that.
Yeah, actually on that, it's a really interesting, what I really loved about his work was he was like, forget your weaknesses, because actually the way to be happier just don't even focus on your weaknesses. Take your strengths and do them better and your weaknesses won't even matter.
Yeah. And that's underpinned in everything, right the way through to neurobiology. You know, the way brain structures form and reform actually underpins that.
Right, I didn't know that.
If you habitual patterns of thought and action are embodied in structures in the brain called dominant neural pathways, and the more you use them, the stronger they become and the more dominant they become, which is another way of explaining habits. It's the neurobiological explanation of habits. If you return to and work on your weaknesses, you actually strengthen the neurite pathways, which are the expression of those weaknesses, so it's counterproductive. In the shower this morning, if that's not TMI, I was listening to Ethan Cross, who is one of my favorite American psychology professors in positive psych. And he was talking about research into how damaging it is to vent, how damaging it is if you're trying to help a friend who's going through it, to sit down and be sympathetic and talk to them about everything that's awful. It actually makes things worse, even though there may be some temporary relief. You both come away from that feeling pants. Whereas if you, with empathy, get them to zoom out and see the bigger picture, it's my, you know that, that's what you did for a living. So it's, I love the fact that we know so much now about what works and what doesn't. What frustrates me is, I shouldn't be frustrated because it creates my profession, but what frustrates me is that the British boardroom, my business is significantly global, if I'm honest, but it's not that big, but it just covers a big part of the world. About boardrooms, if you like, leadership teams in general, is they don't know this stuff. And if they don't know it, they keep getting things wrong. You know, there are some shocking statistics. I mean, unforgivable. How can we live with ourselves statistics? Like, you know, what percentage of employees in Western society are either passively or actively disengaged from their employer? And depending on what survey you look at, it's between 85 and 75%. That's appalling. That is unforgivable. And you know why? Because people's leadership values are crap. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll come on to some details of that. But so informing people, this comes back to your question I postponed, informing people about the evidence is a way of bringing them to the trough. A way of them actually making them drink when you've got them to the trough. So I've always structured our programs which are sort of partnering programs that go on for months or years with organizations. So that the entry point is that we dismiss some myths and produce some shocking facts about what works and what doesn't. And so I will spend a lot of time talking about the benefits of positivity. Not because it's nice to be positive, but because positivity delivers real-time benefits in personal effectiveness and builds psychological resources over time that make a person better and more, bring them closer to their potential in that spectrum that we're talking about. I spent a lot of time talking about kindness and love in the context of leadership, not because I'm some sort of pink and fluffy bunny. I'm not, actually, I'm tough. Yeah, I'm positive, I'm smiley, I'm happy, and I will tell you the truth. And if the truth is that you are cocking up your leadership role, I will tell you, am I permitted to say that on this
podcast? Yeah, okay, of course.
And so actually, one of the things that people don't get is that being a kind, positive leader is much tougher than being a hard ass. Being a hard ass is easy. Actually, being a hard ass is a place frequently where weak people hide. Mm. Yeah, it's much more demanding to be a kind and positive leader, and hugely more effective. Hugely. I mean, if you're into money, if you want to accumulate lots of money, go for kind, go for positive. You'll make a shitload of money if you do that. If you go for being a hard ass, the only money you're going to make is the stuff that you can manipulate out of people, and that may be a ton, and frequently is, but it's not what you could do going the other way.
Yeah, it's making me think, but when we do coaching interventions with people, one of the things I find myself saying quite a lot of the time is don't really be so hard on yourself. It's incredible how many times and how often people will throw darts at themselves that they would never really put up with if somebody else kept coming along and tapping them on the shoulder and saying, you're this, you're not that, you're not the other. But we're quite happy to do it to ourselves in some sort of self-deprecating way.
Exocet missiles, let alone darts.
Yeah, really, really tough stuff that you would never accept from other people. So I think absolutely. And that message needs to be reinforced quite a lot of the time because people slip back easily into that sort of negative view, because we're sort of hardwired to do that, aren't we? That's the first thing that we tend to go for.
Yeah, we do start off with a disadvantage in that we are all predisposed towards pessimism. That's it's a survival trait which was selected in pre-human, pre-mammally actually, in pre-mammalian times. And it explains why, 70% of people in the world are pessimistic. But it's the spectrum of potential again, you see. It's then, does one reinforce that or does one counter it? And naturally optimistic people like, you guys, for instance, you have a very different conditioning experience from people who are falling into the habit of conditioning their pessimism, their negativity all the time. And one of the harsh truths that I love to share with people is that negativity and pessimism require no courage. And that's one of the reasons, John, in answer to your question, why does it happen so much? Is because it takes no courage. Mm-hmm. It takes no effort. It's automatic and easy, as you were implying what you said. Positivity frequently requires courage and requires toughness. And that's one of the reasons that some people find it so challenging. Not because there's anything wrong with them, not because they're you know, weak or horrible or useless. They're none of those things. They're just human. And it's very, very human to move towards things that reward us, like pleasure and success, and to move away from things that cause us discomfort and pain.
Yeah.
So it's you know, I'm obviously, like you, put a lot of time into getting people to stop beating themselves up, and actually get them to recognize that beating yourself up is massively destructive. You know, and it leads to all sorts of psychological conditions. It leads to actual psychopathologies if it's unchecked. Mm-hmm. This whole area, which, you know, I bracket under the label of self-talk, is we put a lot of effort into that. So I think, Rachel, you asked me how we work. So we will partner an organization or a leadership team, or an extended leadership team, you know, second tier leadership team, in an organization over a period of months, and we'll see them probably once a month for a day of teaching. And that's you know, get your pen out, pin your ears back, here's some information you don't have, and it's coming at you fast. It's and then they have access to that material, because we have a blended learning approach. Everything I do, we've created videos, we've got 100 videos that people can access online, and they get the information. And then the next time we're on to topic two, and we take them through that process for up to 8 months. And then the next three sessions is a one-on-one session where we help them with the practical implementation of what we've been teaching them. We address their issues. It's mentoring, it's not coaching, it's giving them answers. It's checking on them, actually. One of the things that we teach people to do is exercises and disciplines which will optimize their own psychology, optimize their own positivity, their effectiveness, their resilience, their creativity, and so on. We hold them to account on how well they are adhering to those guidelines. And if they're not adhering well, we explore in a kind way why not, and help them come up with solutions. I say kind, it's kind in the sense of tough love, lots of empathy, and I'll tell you the truth. Yeah. And my guys will tell you the truth. If you're not doing something because you're, for some unacceptable or unwholesome reason, we'll explore that with you. Very directly.
It's really fascinating, your story from being an accountant and a CFO and somebody very in the detail to this natural curiosity. But what really struck me is that you really are committed to that evidence-based aspect of positive psychology. And I think the thing that's probably the difference between what you do and what we do is people that come to us have they usually already have a natural inclination into they're not living their potential. They're already aware of some of this stuff, and to an extent we therefore have a slightly easier journey, because we don't capture the people that perhaps really need it, but we capture the people that are willing to do the work. What I like about what you're saying, but where I think a lot of people will be surprised is a lot of people tend to think that more rational people, like your financiers and financial people and accountants, are less in tune with their EQ or emotional side of things. But what I really like what you've described is when you actually look at the evidence, positive psychology is very rational in that it works and that it's proven. And what you've explained there is that you've noticed a gap in people's knowledge and that they've gone through this education process without knowing that this works. So here you are giving people the information with the evidence. I mean, Professor Martin Seligman is, you know, the father of positive psychology, but also evidence-based practice.
Yeah.
And I think when you present the facts that way, it's very hard to ignore it, I suppose. And perhaps that's your niche, where you're it's like teaching and learning for people, on something very emotional that actually has a very rational side to it.
Absolutely. I think that what happens with us is that the CEOs, we tend to be brought in by the CEO more than we are brought in by the CHRO, probably 3-1, I would think, because the case for engaging my company is a business case. So we're called the positive profitability company because the reason it makes sense to invest in us is because we will improve your financial results, and you'll get an ROI which is going to blow you away. When I was running that motivational company 20 years ago, that was all about, you know, you should then engage us because we'll motivate people and make everybody feel lovely, which was fine. But it's a different thing. This is now, look, if you are an entrepreneur who's built your business from A to B, and you've got some private equity investment in there now, and your PE backers are wanting to be recycled in 3 years' time, and they want a maximum valuation out of that. And when they get a good valuation, that's going to give you, you get lost money. You get lost money is how much money do you need before you can say to anybody under any circumstances, get lost. It's actually not called that, but you can imagine what the get lost money is really called. And accelerating that process and increasing the return is about improving the profitability of the organization, which we will do because that's the result of working with of everybody adopting these things we're talking about. But it's also about the multiple on which the company is valued. So the company valuations are EBITDA for tax, etc., times the multiple. Which, you know, varies from 4 to 40,000. So how do you maximize the multiple? Well, that's more craft and art than anything else, but it involves things like quality of leadership, like succession planning, staff engagement, like low staff turnover, like super high performance, of individuals and departments and things, and all of that comes from what we do. So it's a hard-nosed business case. So again, it comes back to evidence. Now I've lost track of why I went into that, but it was worth saying. So the approach, I'm going to plug my book now. The approach that we take and the way all of this evidence can be brought together into how do you as a leader or a leadership team maximize the potential of yourself, your people, your career, your outcomes, your shareholders, and all the rest of it is in this. That's positive leaders, positive change. And it's called that because there are lots of words in there that people misunderstand. The first is positive, and I've talked about that. Second is leaders, and towards the end of this, I'm going to talk about what people misunderstand about that. And the third thing is change. And change is another one of those available on all major booksellers and online in Audible and Kindle versions.
Beautiful.
And if you're watching this and you want one and you email me, we'll send you one.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
So I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it.
Well, we will put a link to your book in the show notes for sure and your email.
That is a wonderful plug, that, Graham. Wonderful.
Was it sensitively done? Did you think?
Yes, very, very sensitively done. Thank you for the offer. The motivation piece, I'm really curious. Motivation is obviously massively important for individuals and organizations. How do you fit that in to the positive psychology that you're teaching so that it still grabs people and they want to run with you because they see that there is value in doing that at the end of the program, if you like?
So this is early stage stuff in our program, right? So the first 3 days on our flagship is called New Impetus Diamond. That's the one I've described. So the first 3 days on Diamond, you will get all of the positive psychology about the link between positivity and personal effectiveness, and you know, career effectiveness, all the rest of it. After that, we're heavily into organizational psychology and how to deliver an ethos which will maximize the outcome. So, you know, positive psychology informs everything we do, but it's not everything that we do. So, for instance, the word change here is there because people don't understand how to change, and they're all, you know, it's big elephant in the room. Let's step back. Let's be honest with ourselves. The world is full of people. You all know lots of people who's listening to this. You might yourself be one of those people who has wanted to be more patient or slimmer or more heavily muscled or whatever for decades, and you've never succeeded. And the thing that burns me, sorry, I am coming back to your question, John. The thing that burns me is that people conclude, because we've inherited this misinformed Victorian character strength myth, that we think the reason that I can't stick to the diet or hit the gym 5 days a week like I promised myself I would on the 1st of January is because I'm weak. Yeah. And that massively damages self-esteem, right? And self-esteem is another thing that's misunderstood. Nobody can have too much. The link between self-esteem and arrogance is completely misunderstood. Arrogance is a low self-esteem issue. So that's because we believe that we change through force of will and strength of character. Bullshit. We don't. We change through conditioning. All right? It's conditioning that changes us. So once somebody understands how to do that, they then know how to change. I'm going back to your question. This is such a clever answer. Such a good link I'm doing here. I'm blowing myself away. So it's then about, okay, so you know what to change. And you know how to change it because you just learned it. It's cognitive behavioral psychology, actually. Do you know how to change? The question is, why aren't you doing it? Now, that's a motivational question. Oh, I didn't even know I was going to do that. So the thing is, why don't people then do what they need to do when they need to do it to deliver the thing that's possibly the most important thing in the world to them, if they're honest about it, as far as their own self in here is concerned? And the answer is because of the relationship between emotional state and motivation. Okay, so it's another, you know, there are many ways in which our biological evolution massively lags our social evolution. So in a pre-human, It was actually quite important if something bad was happening in the environment that you hide, yeah?
Yeah.
That your motivation, you're experiencing negative emotions like fear and sadness because your Uncle Mary's just been predated by the thing with big, Uncle Mary, the thing with big teeth, with big teeth, right? So the two responses, if we simplify it. One response is, okay, I'm frightened and I'm sad, so I'm going to sit at the back of the cage until I feel a bit better. Those people tended to survive. That's how natural selection works. The other response is, I feel highly motivated to go and attack the thing with big teeth. Those people didn't survive so much. And, you know, 1,000 other scenarios which are like that and more subtle but equally powerful has led to the fact that when we are experiencing any sort of negative emotion, our motivation is literally switched off in here, just behind the forehead. It's literally switched off. And one of the massive benefits of positivity is that when you're in a positive emotional state, your motivation is switched on. So when you wake up in the morning and you know what you should be doing is getting into your running gear and hitting the streets, even though it's cold and wet and still dark, and you don't want to do it, yeah? If you're in a positive state, you'll do it. But actually, the fact that you're feeling a bit down about life means you won't do it. Mm. So that's how it goes wrong. I tell people to watch out for their creams, okay? the five benefits of positivity in real time. These are all things which turned on and off by emotional states. So turned on by positive emotional states and turned off by negative emotional states, we have creativity, emotional intelligence, Rachel, yeah, analytical intelligence in just the same way, and motivation, okay? Building up over time, whenever we are experiencing positive emotional states, is resilience and self-esteem. So that creams is the entry point to our programs as to why is it important to be positive. You know that, can I tell you another story about Seligman and his work?
Yes.
So one of the things that came out of his work is that the thing that, if you go through trauma, yeah, genuine trauma, then we all know from our life experience that some people are crushed by it, some people grow through it. So psychologists talk about the difference between post-traumatic stress disorder and post-traumatic growth. And the thing that makes the difference is resilience, okay? Seligman's work demonstrated, and lots of other people working in the field, there are hundreds of famous positive psychologists now, have demonstrated that resilience is built through positive emotional states, okay? The evidence for that is so overwhelming that in 2008, the US Army retained Martin Seligman to teach 30,000 of their senior NCOs in how to teach all of their junior NCOs to be positive psychology coaches. I get so many nods here from people who know this story. Yeah. And since then, since 2009, every NCO in the US Army is a positive psychology coach. You know, there are 1.5 million people in that army. Okay, so what's the effect been? Lots of massive results, but the things that blow me away are that post-traumatic stress disorder has halved, anxiety and depression have halved, and substance abuse has halved through building resilience. These are some of the stories that I use to get leadership teams to buy into a positive way of life and managing your own psychology for positivity. Because although the leadership teams that engage us, or the CEOs that engage us, are going to be positive, otherwise they won't want anything to do with me because I'm going to call them out. Yeah.
Yeah.
The people that work for them are not necessarily the same. So you're quite right, Rachel, when you say that, you know, we often meet people in the classroom who are not naturally positive, who are skeptical, sometimes cynical, sometimes genuinely opposed. And we have to turn them around through the evidence.
I think coming back to the conversation that you and John were having before around how in coaching sometimes, and a lot of leaders, you know, in general, will have periods of time when they throw darts at themselves, and I did want to pick up on that when you were chatting about it, because a lot of the leaders that we come across and a lot of people that go into leadership really do want the best for their people, and they will want positive things for their people. But the behavior that they're demonstrating is to throw darts or grenades to themselves. And it's really hard when people don't do what you tell them to do. And we see this a lot where team leaders and managers are saying, no, you go home and spend time with your family, but they're working all night and they're doing all the hours.
I think
what's nice about your program is you're trying to do a coaching and a training program of everybody starting at the top, because you could be the most caring manager or leader that you like, but if you're not caring and looking after yourself, your team aren't going to respond to it, because they can literally feel the negativity and the fact that you're self-attacking yourself. So really, as a leader, it should be to be positive for yourself first and foremost, for the benefit of everybody else.
Bang on. One of my clients came up with it. Well, I think he came up with it. Came up with the phrase, shadow of the leader, which is a lovely idea. I prefer to think of it as the sunshine of the leader, but, you know, his friend.
We call it the leadership shadow. The higher the higher you are, the bigger the shadow you cast. And you could just do one or two things that day, and people remember it for months.
Yeah. And yes, nice. And one of the things in play in the whatever you want to call it, the way a leader massively influences an organization is the principle of duplication. So people look up at their leader and they think, you know, I like what they've got, I'd like some, so I'll do what they do. And if what they do is throw darts at themselves, then, you know, oh right, so you have to be self-critical to succeed. That's not a conscious decision. It's not even an unconscious decision. It's partly an autonomic decision, right? So for those of the listeners who aren't familiar with that word, autonomic means literally hardwired into our nervous system. So we duplicate the behavior of our leaders. Sometimes we may completely reject the behavior of our leaders, and there's still an autonomic component of duplication. It's less straightforward in that situation, but it's so as a leader, you have a massive responsibility to behave exactly as you want the intermediate leaders that you're bringing up to behave, and the people in the depths of the organization, if I can use that without being too P, non-C, to behave. You have to be that person. If you're not capable of being that person, you need to be helped to be that person. And if after you've been helped to be that person, you're still not that person, now I told you I was tough, then you need to go. Hmm. Right? And I have that conversation with CEOs from time to time.
So when you're working with CEO, senior leadership team, extended leadership team, how successful do you find their ability, Graham, to pass down the information that they've learnt, this positivity, their ability to motivate those people when they've not had the same touch points as you?
So totally useless at it. Sorry, I'm playing. Right, there is a serious point. So I guarantee that if you give me a room full of people, I will turn at least 98% of them into people who are on board with hope, positivity, and optimism. I guarantee it, okay? In order to do that, I need at least 4 days with them in a classroom, right? So to think that somebody who's not a professional psychologist, yeah, can actually do it just by osmosis in the workplace is crazy. It's crazy. So the impact that one can make through one's own positivity as a senior or intermediate leader is less than the complete transformation. However, it's still very real, right? Now, one of the ways that we address this is that I think it's the third day of our flagship New Impetus Diamond. On the third day, we get people to bring their key direct reports along. Right. And that day is we call it highlights. And it's a highlights day to explain to their reports what we're doing with the bosses and why. And it's an opportunity to use the evidence to buy those people in, okay? And then we give those people access to a truncated version of the blended learning video program on our portal, so that they can continue to use it. And we then monitor whether they're using it or not. And we might mention to their bosses who's really on board.
And do those people that get brought along as direct reports, Graham, do they have a voice in that? In that arena, are they able to challenge back?
Yeah,
because I'm also guessing that, well, it almost would be a bit counterintuitive in some respects. You get brought along by your boss and you're explaining to these people what you're going to do with their boss, and then they've got this idea whether they can stand up and say, yeah, but you'll never fix him, or you'll never be able to move that lady around.
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? Of course, there's the issue of people having the balls to say that in front of their boss. So it doesn't happen very often. But what they can do freely and openly is challenge me and my ideas. So I don't so much talk about what we're doing with the boss. We talk about why positive psychology delivers well-being and profitability.
Because of course they've not heard it, have they?
They haven't. Well, they haven't.
No.
They do like to say they have. Oh, yeah, I've heard this all before. But it's like, no, you haven't. Because you haven't read my book and you haven't listened to me before. So subtle. Such a child. That's the other thing. I'm big into playfulness. You know, it's great. So long as you choose the appropriate moment.
On the playfulness thing, I know that the research is sketchy on her work, but I really do love the theory of it. Barbara Fredrickson's broaden and build theory around what we learn in play widens our thought action repertoire, and then that helps us when when we're in a stress or a trigger situation and we narrow and you really need to come out of it. And I think she did initial research where it was like, that was where that for every one negative comment you say you need, was it like 5 to 8 positives? And I know the research was sketchy improving that and she kind of got discredited. But about that thing about play and positivity, the theory is right? And you can't be creative, you can't be innovative when you're in a stress response and you don't have access to these things. And it makes so much sense. But how many leaders hold their people in this state of, you must come up with an answer, we're under pressure, it's stressful, there's no budget, and expect this exceptional work?
Well, it's you know, in the context of this conversation we're having, because we're all on board, we're all familiar with the evidence. You know, it's patently ridiculous for leaders to behave like that. It's completely counterproductive. It's, you know, even once you know the facts, it's stupid. I mean, you know, I was explaining about creams, creativity, which is the thing that goes on in the cerebral cortex, the bit on the outside you can see of the brain, is literally switched off when our stress reaches the tipping point level, which isn't very high for most people. So specifically, if you say to somebody, unless you come up with a new idea by Thursday, you're fired, you're guaranteed they won't.
But we live in a world of deadlines.
I know. It's crackers. But if you look at the people who are the greatest creatives in business, so Edison held the world record for over 100 years, nearly 100 years, sorry, and personal patents. But there's a Japanese gentleman who's beaten him by an order of magnitude called Nakajima, I think. Those of you that know his name will now be laughing at me. But it's interesting to look at the way that he goes about turning on his creativity, and it's by creating an environment that induces relaxation, absence of stress, getting his brain as close to alpha rhythm as he can. And, you know, the people that have used alpha rhythm techniques in order to produce creativity are astonishing. I think I mentioned it in my book, actually, I can't remember. But, you know, going back to René Descartes, who we all love because he invented algebra, you know, Napoleon, Winston Churchill, Thomas Edison, Salvador Dali, they all had specific relaxation techniques which were there to induce a creative act. I call them the dozers and the droppers. The droppers are people who would hold something in their hand and let their thoughts drift and approach sleep. And of course, sooner or later, they would be on the brink of sleep and they'd drop the thing that would wake them up and they would start writing or start painting.
Yeah, I think was that Edison that used to...
Edison was the man with the balls in the brass bowls, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You can even go and see his chair now if you go to whatever it is, Park.
Fascinating stuff. I'm not making a particular connection with this next question, Graham, but it's such a pervasive value, if you like. But
nervous face.
So many businesses, so many organizations, and so many people are sort of ruled by time. Time's the ultimate currency, if you like. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are around time in operating a positive psychological kind of framework in your mind.
Okay, so there are a couple of things. So the first one is whether you're talking about time or setting budgets or motivating your followers, that the absolute golden rule is creams. You need to optimize your creams, you need to optimize their creams, because creams is our effectiveness. How effective are you going to be? How fast can you work? How creatively can you work? How effectively can you work? So that's the first golden rule. But there is another, and that one of the things that people do is they waste a lot of time asking the conscious mind to undertake tasks that it's not designed for. So one of the things I teach people to do is how to use their unconscious mind to undertake complex tasks, because that's what it's for. And the bandwidth of the conscious mind is shockingly microscopic. And one of the things that we do is we will sometimes use our tiny little, you know, Sinclair ZX3 or whatever, to check the our conscious mind, to check the work of the 47 Cray supercomputers, i.e. our unconscious mind, that has just produced an idea. So getting your unconscious task, and we all know that. We all know if you sleep on a problem, it becomes clearer. That's just handing it over to the unconscious. Mm. So it's the two ways. It's learning how to use the right part of your brain, the right part of your mind, specifically, and not brain, is that. And the second is making sure that you and your people are always in a high-performance state. And sometimes people in business are going to find themselves trapped between a lack of resources and an impossible deadline and an unreasonable shareholder or boss. That's reality. How do you handle that? To the best of your ability. How can you guarantee that? Creams.
I think people listening to this might be wanting to know some kind of quick and easy wins that they could do to increase their positivity and to tap into creams. What would be your kind of tips to get them started?
Come on, Rach, I normally make people pay for that shit.
Give us a freebie.
the simplest is really easy. I call it PIPO, positives in, positives out. So it's the heart of cognitive behavioral psychology, not therapy, psychology. Yeah. It is, if you fill your brain with negativity, negative conditioning, bad news in the newspapers, soap opera negativity on the telly, reality shows, lots of darts being lobbed at yourself. If you fill your brain with that sort of negativity, it will deliver negativity. On the other hand, if you take control of the inputs to your brain and make sure they're all positive, not pink and fluffy, lovely positive, but genuinely positive experiences, positive thoughts, positive TV programs, positive reading, positive listening, positive reading. There we are, another chance to plug the book. Such a whore. Then it's when you do that, that will make a massive, massive, massive difference. So eliminating every source of negative conditioning in your life that you can, and maximizing. So it's like spending less time with negative people. Yeah. Now you can't always do that if it's your husband or your mum, you know, suck it up. You're stuck with that. But if it's a casual acquaintance you sometimes see in the pub who's always moaning or likes to tell gossip, you don't have to spend any time with those people. So, eliminating things like that, or whether it's you know, stopping spending three hours a day listening to and watching the news. It's 95% negative. And although we need to know what's going on in the world, we don't need 3 hours a day. 15, 20 minutes is fine. Yeah. So it's that. Eliminate the negative. Seek out the positive. Find positive people in your life and spend more time with them. Friends, family, colleagues. If your boss is the most positive person in the world, ask them for more exposure to them. One of my heroines in business is a woman, I won't name her because I don't have her permission. She's a heroine of mine for many reasons. I'm afraid I am a bit of a bloke. One of them is that she's so beautiful, but she is also fantastically successful. And the beauty is not irrelevant. Let me explain why. She was at a very senior role in a global organization. And at her level in that organization, out of about 80,000 people, there were 70 people. The level above her, there were 20 people globally. She wanted to be one of the 20. So what she did was she specifically would call the global CEO twice a year and say, I'm going to be in your part of the United States in pick a month. And I thought I'd like to have 20 minutes with you so I can update you on what I'm doing and just take guidance from you on whether I'm getting that right and what else you need me to be thinking about. Okay. And I think the first quality I mentioned, for which I apologize, I don't want to be misunderstood. I think that enabled her that would succeed. She had, you know, and of course she didn't happen to be in that state. She was traveling there just to see the guy to get that done. Now, the reason that that's relevant is if you are watching this and you do happen to be a beautiful man or woman, and one of the things that it's worth becoming aware of is that we human beings treat you really well. We will go out of our way to help you, to be nice to you, and to help you further your goals. We're going to be really nice to you. Whether we're just serving you in a shop or whether we're working with you, we're going to be really nice to you. And one of the things that one needs to be aware of, if you are a stunner of either gender, is that in order to be resilient, our conditioning does not need to be wholly positive. It needs to be 80% positive. We need the 20% negative experience to actually create some strength, build some resilience. And one of the things that happens to very beautiful people is sometimes they get zero negative, okay? Which is partly behind some of the very famous, very beautiful people we see that become flaky, yeah? It's the fact that they're not having the opportunity to build strength. So like everything I say and teach, even when I'm telling a joke, there's some hard evidence-based science behind it.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, though, as to why you do wonder why so many really beautiful people end up taking their own lives or things like that. Uh-huh. And perhaps if they're not exposed to any of that negativity, they don't get to build the strength. But why we do actually bend over backwards to help them. So it's something that needs to be managed, doesn't it?
I bet all of us can remember in our younger lives when we're all just starting to date, you know, and we can all remember that person that we knew who was like just out of this world gorgeous, who was lonely.
Mm. Yeah,
because people wouldn't approach them.
Mm.
My wife was one of them, my ex-wife. Mm. I won her, but I couldn't hang on. Well, I hung on for 35 years. And indeed, we became friends because I used to be her go-to date so that I would go with her to parties just as a mate to help her get over that. The fact that nobody would approach her because I don't know. Okay, no evidence on this. I don't know why it is, but there seems to be there seems to be a timidity. And I think that's partly, this is just me extemporizing now, I think that's partly behind what you're talking about, Rachel, and that I think that that combination of lack of resilience and loneliness, and also, you know, this is getting a bit darker than I want to get, but, you know, there's also the whole thing about not everybody treats beautiful people well, do they?
No.
I think there's also that there's also that thing, isn't there, Graham, around people's self-esteem. So maybe people won't approach somebody who in their mind is beautiful because their comparison is that they won't be accepted by that person because of their own self-esteem or their own view of themselves.
And yeah, and the and
I'm never good enough.
Why would we flinch from that? So you see you're in a bar and on their own, 10 feet away from you is perfection.
Yeah.
You know, why would you not just say hello? It's about self-esteem, and one of the key relationships is between resilience and self-esteem. Low self-esteem, low resilience go hand in hand. And if you're not resilient, things hurt more.
Yeah.
So being rejected hurts more. Okay.
Let's bring it back to the tips, because you were talking about that lady who used to go and ask for that 20 minutes with the global CEO. And I don't want you to go off tangent and shortchange us. One more free tip, please.
Oh, I was just enjoying talking about dating, but okay. A single man, you see. So so you want another tip for how to manage your own creams. Okay, well actually, honestly, the positives in, positives out is what it's all about. I suppose the next stage of understanding is that the majority of our conditioning, the majority of the, of whether it's positives or negatives that are going in, the majority of that is self-generated, okay? So it comes back to, I think you've both alluded to this during the course of this encounter, which is that the conversations that we have in here about ourselves are not always full of admiration and self-love. They're often highly critical and full of self-loathing. So learning how to, it's not quite so easy to do this in 5 minutes, but learning how to turn those negative self-critical conversations into positive ones that are still realistic is very important. One of the things that the positive thinking movement got wrong was that towards the end, one of the signs of it was my favorite author's name, Shad Helmstetter, and Shad wrote the book What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. One of the things that people got excited about was the idea that if you talk yourself up and you talk the future of your dreams into your life, it's going to work. But what was misunderstood and has been actually this century conclusively proven is that self-talk, things that you say to yourself, changing what goes on here, if it's just bullshit, if you don't believe it, if it's just a bunch of lies, it has no effect on you at all. So you have to find ways of telling a more positive story in here in such a way that it will connect with your own beliefs about what's possible and likely, at the same time as being completely positive. Now in that you need one's probably going to need some guidance. Indeed, if you're clinically depressed, you get very specific guidance on how to do that, as probably one in five of the people who listen to this will know, because that's the statistic about clinical depression. That's how common it is. It's one of the things that, one of the most shocking things to tell people, particularly with the horrendous things that are happening in India at the moment, God love them all, is that COVID is far from the biggest pandemic in the world. The biggest pandemic in the world is clinical depression. by an order of magnitude, I'm afraid.
And I think that's the thing that's so frightening about clinical depression is then I think it only reinforces learned helplessness when you think you need medication to get better. And really, you need to be, in some cases, medication is necessary, but you also need to change the self-talk. And that in itself will create more neuropathways to be able to recognize when you're in there and get yourself out of it. But because we're so strained, we're just telling people as a society, no, you need medical treatment, which reinforces learned helplessness.
There's a chapter in one of Seligman's books. It's either in Authentic Happiness or in Flourish that is entitled, remember this, The Pharmaceutical Industry's Dirty Little Secret.
I've read that chapter, yeah.
Don't read it if you're a clinically depressed person. Read it when you get better.
Yeah. So they're your tips. That's probably a good time for us to move on to our leadership essentials. So take it away. What would be your
tips? So forgive me for looking away from the camera. I'm actually bringing my prompt across from the adjacent monitor. Okay. So I think it's a lovely idea for you to ask people to give their leadership essentials. It's wonderful. I'm slightly not going to cooperate because I think there is one. And then I will give you another three ideas. Well, I'm probably giving you eight. But the only thing, that consultants and training companies love to complicate things because if they come up with a new complex idea, they think it gives them an edge in the marketplace. Okay. And the leadership canon is full of unnecessary complex stuff. It's also full of a fundamental error, which is that, Richard Branson and Horatio Nelson are historically two of the greatest leaders that our country has ever seen. So if we do what they do, we will be a great leader too. Okay. Wrong. Okay. Fundamentally, completely and utterly wrong. Branson made his style work for him because of who and how he is. If you try to do what he does, you're going to flop. Otherwise, we'd all be billionaires. Because he's written so many books on how to do what he does, there would be billionaires on every street corner. Okay, so that's the first thing. Don't follow your favorite leader's habits because you're not them, so it won't work for you. To return to the number one thing. The number one thing is all about positive affect. Affect. Okay, what emotional reaction does a leader create in the people they want to lead? If it is positive, it will work. If it is negative or neutral, it will not. You see, leadership has something in common with trust and love and gratitude and forgiveness. Okay. I shall pause for people to be thinking what that might be. And it is this: it cannot be taken, it cannot be coerced, it cannot be demanded, it can only be given. I can give you my love, I cannot take yours. I can give you my forgiveness, I cannot demand yours. I can give you my followership, you cannot demand it of me. So there's all the difference in the world between seniority or authority and leadership. When your board or your boss puts you in a position of authority, they give you an opportunity to become a leader. Even if the title that you get is XYZ lead, yeah, it doesn't make you a leader. You become a leader when somebody in your team says either openly or in their mind to you, I will follow you, then you're a leader. In philosophical terms, it is a condition that is both necessary and sufficient. Yeah. So that means that one has to think all the time about the people that you want to become your followers, the people you want to lead. And all the time, you have to be thinking about what impact you are having on them. So a good leader's awareness is not in here, but it's in there. It's in them. Even when you're caught between a deadline, a budget, and recalcitrant colleagues, making sure that you create positive emotional affect in the people you're due to lead or influence, you know, your peers, your boss as well, is the way to guarantee that you'll be an effective leader. One of the things that happens is that in an organization where the leaders as a group are creating positive emotional affect in the majority of people, is that the engagement scores are high. Engagement is another thing that's full of bullshit, okay? People engage with an organization that has positive emotional affect on them, okay? And in that situation, what happens is that the bulk of the people, the engaged people in an organization, are deliver high levels of discretionary effort. Okay, discretionary effort, the difference between what you need to do to survive in post and what you choose to do. It's a big thing. And discretionary effort makes the difference between organizations that are winning out there in the competitive stakes and organizations that aren't. So your number one job as a leader is to release discretionary effort in your people. And the only way you can do that is through positive emotional affect. So you have to center on them. There are other things that are also in play. One of them is people's view of the fairness of the distribution of rewards. This is, again, me telling the truth. Look, if you're a CEO and your salary is 10 times the average salary of people in supervisor level, people are going to be cool with that. You know, I'm earning 50 grand, she's earning 500. That's cool. Look who she is. That's cool. I can live with that. However, if you're not earning 500, but you're earning 50 million, nobody is cool with that. Nobody is cool with that because everybody knows that that could have been spread more equitably. So I said earlier that we've got maybe 20% only of people who are engaged, 80% who are disengaged. Why? Things like that. So don't ever waste your money on trying to improve the engagement scores in your company if you are dead set on earning 50 million and not paying anybody else more than 200 grand a year. Okay, it's not going to work. So that's number one, right?
And then, I think that's our longest record for number one ever. Well done. Yeah, keep going. This is fascinating stuff. Number two, please go.
Okay, the second thing is that, so these are three other mindset things that are important, and it's important whether you're a leader or not. The first thing is that in terms of impact on effectiveness of an individual or an organization, positivity trumps everything.
Right.
Everything. If you want to improve the performance of a person or a company, improve their positivity. Okay, this is evidence. It's proven peer-reviewed research. If you want to know the arguments for that, because it would take me a day, that's set out very clearly in here. Okay, drop us a line, we'll send you one. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that. Traditional thinking tells us that if we are in a senior leadership role responsible for the financial performance of a department or a business unit or a company, we're probably going to have to make a choice between making sure that we deliver the best financial performance we can and treating our people well, okay? That's what we're traditionally brought up. You have to decide where you're going to be on that spectrum. Okay, The next evidence-based thing to embrace is that is a false dichotomy. The way to the former is through the latter. You will always super high perform as an organization if you take care of the well-being and positivity of your people, okay? Because you improve engagement, you maximize their creams for more of the time, it just super delivers. Unfortunately, it's that is sometimes challenging for people to buy in, because we all know so many people who are conspicuously successful and wealthy who are, got to say it, bastards, okay? So the research into that had to be able to explain that, okay? It was done by a team involving Fredrickson. Fredrickson's reputation is now massively recovered. She's associated with a couple of things. Yeah. She's like a goddess. She's all over my shelves. She's there.
I love her.
World authority on emotion, Barbara Fredrickson, the number one. So the research had to address what the Americans call the SOB paradox, a son of a bitch paradox. Okay, how come so many sons of make them? And basically there are other strategies which overcome that. They tend to have people whose job it is just to fix the emotional damage that they create surrounding them. That's the first answer. The second answer is if they did adopt positivity, they'd make even more money. It's quite interesting. The reason that they can succeed, even though they do behave badly, is because they're so massively talented. I'm not saying they're not talented. I'm saying they're talented, but they're not doing everything that they could. I've met several people who are multimillionaires running enormous organizations who feel crap about themselves because they know they're not achieving their potential. And one of the reasons is they're not as positive as they should be. One of the things I enjoy most about my job is working with CEOs and people whose salaries are more than my turnover, right? and it's like, yeah, but you know, if you were even better at being nice to people and putting other people's interests first, you know that instead of, and I think of somebody very specific who's in this, okay, you know that instead of being the managing director of a relatively small European geography, you would be on the main board in the USA where you belong, because that's how good you are. But the reason you're not up there is because you piss people off, because you treat them with contempt. And so they don't let you into the big game. You're not going to come and play at my table because you're an ass.
I think just to pick up on what you said about positive affect and treating people well will get the most out of things. I think we've all been in organizations where you're dangled a carrot. It's like, if you do this well first, then you will get the reward, versus let's spend the time and effort on people now because we know that that will get more out of everybody. And instead we operate in this cycle of the reward comes after, or you can only have that nice stuff that you want about your well-being or flexible working or time off when you've proven that you're worthy of it. And therein lies the dilemma.
It is. And if we come back to my simplistic, it's not simplistic, it's very sophisticated. If we come back to the simple truth at the center of how to be a good leader, when you say to somebody, you can have your well-being benefits when you've proven that you need them, what emotional affect does that have? It makes them feel undervalued and angry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. My last thing then that I wanted to share is when you're thinking about organizational cultures, stop thinking about organizational cultures and think about organizational ethos. Because ethos is the combination of leadership values and behavior, the organizational culture, and the engagement climate in the organization. So ethos is about how do we treat each other, how do we treat our leaders, and how do we treat the company. So you cannot improve any of them without improving all of them. Okay, so that's actually where my book ends up positively, there's positive change. And it's where my programs end up. It is, how do you deliver not any one of them, but all of them together? Because if you are, if you think about the organization, if you're working now in a complex organization and you think about where it's going wrong, you can probably find it in a conflict between A, what it says the culture and leadership should be and what it actually is, true. But secondly, between behaviors and values and say the engagement scores that are coming on. You know, so for instance, if you're saying that it's very important for us that we have a positive and empowering culture, but at the same time, leaders are put under negative pressure, and it's okay for them to negatively motivate, it's not going to work because they're not consistent. So that's my third one.
What a lovely way to wrap up the conversation. Thank you so much. They were really, really powerful, really inspiring. The book's well worth the read. Do you want to give it one more plug?
I do. Thank you. Have you got half an hour? So here it is. It's the subtitle, which is where we come from, is Game-Changing Psychological Insights into Maximizing Profitability and Well-Being. Profitability and well-being are synergistically linked. You cannot optimize one unless you're also optimizing the other. How to do that is simple in theory, and you know, takes a bit of planning and thought and some consistent behavior across the whole piece. And that's what this is about. And the whole idea of this is that you read this and think, oh, I understand. So how do I do that? Then you call me.
Yeah. So it's Positive Leaders, Positive Change, if people would like to get a copy. But we will also drop your email in the show notes so people could get in touch to request one. That's such a kind offer. Thank you. Spreading lots of positive effect there. I like what you've done.
It's on Audible. The only one we can let you have is a copy of the hardback. If you go on Amazon, you find the Kindle, and you'll on Audible, you will also find me reading the thing in my own sweet dulcet tones.
Wonderful, Graham. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and so much for sharing that. We're really interested in the positive psychology, John, don't we? We need to make a more conscious effort to do it more often, because it is actually contagious, though, isn't it? Which is wonderful. It is. You need to put more in to get more out.
Yeah,
it's been an honor and a real pleasure. I've enjoyed this so much. Thank you.
Lovely. You're very welcome.
Thank you, Graham.
Nice to spend time with kindred spirits. Thanks, John.
You've been listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching.